Well, why don't we just get started with the talk a little bit here? Especially since I like to talk so much once I get going and try to have to pull myself back. But I want to start our talk with a little story, a little clip. Looking for stories, and I go to my traditional dare to do motivation, but I couldn't find anything about the five aggregates and how to explain it. And then I stumbled upon this video clip. It's only a minute and 26 seconds long. It packs a punch. So there's a lot in here for us to unpack. I think Lauren's meditation was perfect for us being able to see in real time, in a moment in time. It's probably the clearest example of a moment in time and what Buddha was pointing to about the aggregates. And the thing is, what did you call them? Asanas?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it. I don't
It's
know those.
the asavas. And so
Oh, the
asavas.
asavas. Yes,
So
sorry about that. No wonder. I didn't know
this is
they
a
were.
perfect. This is a perfect short 1 minute little thing that will show you, I think, exactly what the Buddha was pointing to, better than I've ever seen anything show it. And when we see it in a clip, it's better to me than having us talk about it so it's conceptual. I think this clip will help us feel it. So I'm going to share my screen here. And get this all. This is it. Optimize. Okay. So you guys can see a black screen there, like my YouTube thing, right? All right. So when I make the full screen, I can't tell whether you can see it or not. So you'll just have to tell me.
Can.
You can. Okay. So I'm assuming you can hear it. If you can't hear it, then you let me know.
Yep.
Okay.
It's good.
Right. Perfect.
Awesome job. You know what I'm thinking? Snack time. Okay, let's see what we have here. Which one do you want? That wasn't nice of Rachel. Where did she pick up those greedy tendencies? Taking both apples and biting into them. That's so unlike her.
Dad?
What is it, honey?
Have this one. This apple's more juicier and sweeter.
All right. Is that cute? Did you catch it? Did you see how his thought turned, he left the truth of the moment and he became whatever his thought was. What he thought was happening became what was happening. And I love the way her voice comes in as pulling him back into reality because he was gone. And all of that happens in an instant. He saw something. There's a perception, a feeling tone like, oh, she shouldn't have done that. That's wrong. That's unpleasant. This perception, consciousness, all of that creates what we call reality. Not reality, what we call reality. And that is what we began to live our lives out of. That was just such a clear moment. And reality, the real thing that is reality, has to pull us back in. And the practices around the asavas and the aggregates, and I'll talk about the asavas at another time, but I just wanted to say that they're really called the floodings, and so they're that flooding that happened to him. The flooding itself, how he went from a thought about a perception into that existence as it was. And even the way they had it, where you hear us talking, you hear him talking, and all of a sudden reality came about what he was saying in his mind. Just the way that whole clip showed, that's what we do. This is what the Buddha was pointing to, was the problem with freedom, is because we are tied to these aggregates as if these aggregates are the truth. And they're not. They're just five aspects of an experience. But they're fleeting. Like Lauren said so beautifully, they're fleeting. They're all subject to the three characteristics. They're impermanent. They're, you know, subject to change. They're impersonal. They're not going to satisfy us. They're not really speaking to the moment, the truth of the experience. They're speaking to their own, how could you say, their own view of it. Like that example of an elephant, and everybody's at a different place in the elephant, so they don't know they're talking about an elephant. Everybody's talking about, you know, a snake or, you know, I don't know. I can't remember all the little different aspects of the elephant. But the point is that depending on where you're located at, what you think you're perceiving is very different. And so the fact that she took two, which to her understanding is, how can I tell you which one I want? I got to taste them. I mean, that's how we know whether we want an apple or not, right? You got to taste it and say, yeah, I want this. Or you taste it and be like, yeah, no, got the wrong one. So for him to offer her a choice doesn't make any sense unless she experiences it. So taking both of them from her perspective would make total sense. Let me taste them and then see. And in her true nature, she wanted to give him the best tasting one. So sweet, isn't it? And I thought it was perfect for Father's Day. Just the whole thing seemed to make sense to me. This is what we are working with. When we're practicing with these aggregates, we're not trying to not feel. Like, he can't not feel, or he can't even not think what he's thinking. The second reason why I thought that clip was so, well, another reason, is because he didn't really say anything to her. You could tell how she had to pull him back. And he was so far gone that he didn't even really answer her in a very connected way. It was sort of like he was still in his own thinking. Like, yeah, yeah, baby. You know, like, you know, we do that, right? We still think we know what we're seeing, but we're trying to pretend like we're all engaged. Everything's nice. And it wasn't until he actually heard her that he let go. And in that coming into the truthful moment, he let go of his image of what he thought was going on. And he just moved right into the truth of it, right? Did you see that little kind of like letting go and moving into the truth of it? That moment of letting go, seeing, oh, I was wrong. and moving into the truth of it is what I think the practice of the aggregates are. The flooding of the asavas demonstrates how quickly we go into the aggregate. So if this practice were about, yeah, you need to don't get caught up in those aggregates. You can see from that clip, it was a minute 26 seconds. You can see how quickly we flow into the aggregates. It would be delusional to say, I'm going to practice so I don't let that happen to me. That can't be what practice is about. What I think practice is pointing to is the escape. It's like that. Sutta with the arrows. When the Buddha gave that example of the two arrows, and he divided, he said, for those of you that don't know, he was talking about how experience happens to us. And he said that you could think of experience as like an arrow or a dart, and that we experience that dart and the painful experience of that first getting hit with an arrow. And then we pile on by hitting ourselves in the same place a second time with a mental pile on about it. So his first arrow was seeing her grab two apples, right? Grab them both and taking two bites. Great job. That was the first arrow because it hit him like greed, like painful. The second arrow was the mental sort of world he began to spin around. How could she be that way? Where did she get that from? And you could almost sense he was internalizing it. We taught her that. She learned that from us. I can't believe that. That kind of getting caught up in that moment in time. His own perception, and his perception was wrong. But he filled it all in and he began to mentally spin in it. The second arrow is the harder of the two. And that is why the sound of her faraway voice saying, Dad, you know, like calling him back into the present moment, into reality, is what made that clip so poignant for me. That what the Buddha was pointing to was the four foundations of mindfulness is what pulls us back into reality from a habitual way of being pulled out into the aggregates or the asavas. It's like they're called the floods. So they flood us into those aggregates, and we don't necessarily, we get to clinging and we don't see that we're in aggregates. And the aggregates, it's weird. Buddha in Pali is called khandhas. I'll tell you what this has to do with emotions here in a second. They're called khandhas in Pali. And Buddha took a word that was very commonplace. He did a lot of this. He took a word that was very commonplace at the time. We think of it as, oh, the khandhas. But it would be like, it is the word piles. Right? Piles of laundry, piles of books, piles of paper. We're used to that word piles. It's not like some sacred word. Piles. What are the piles? We don't think of it. It's just like piles, right? That's it. That's how commonplace the word was. Even though we hold khandhas as a practice opportunity, at the time when the Buddha was talking about it, it was a commonplace word.
Can you hear that?
Excuse me? Oh. In this commonplace word, he went further and said that our existence is made up of a pile of piles of things. Just piles of
form, which is the body parts, skin, organs. It's not like our skin and our organs can do anything on their own, right? They're just skin and organs, just the piles of fleshy things. We call it the fleshy parts pile. And this is the pile that has all the fleshy parts. And you can look at that. Oh, those are, I can see some, you know, organs in there, some lungs and some hearts. Oh, I see. Those little tiny kidneys, I can see those things, you know, that spleen. What is that for anyway, you know? But you can see that little fleshy part in there. Then there are piles of feelings, pleasant feelings, unpleasant, neutral feelings, all kinds of feeling tones, piles of it. It's not a thing, a noun. It's like the river that Thich Nhat Hanh said. It's just piles of this thing, piles of thoughts. We have thousands of thoughts, thousands and hundreds, millions, billions of thoughts that we've thought over our lifetime. And I really believe we have some thoughts of other people that's been around us. We have their thoughts too. It's not like I'm only limited to my own little thoughts because I have a little thought box inside the skin. It's not like that. So if I can tell when my son is thinking stuff, and I know what he's thinking. I can tell you. He won't accept that I know what he's thinking, but I know what he's thinking. He says, I'm not thinking that. Yes, he is. Don't even think about it. You know we know what people are thinking. So the piles of thoughts, we have piles of perceptions. Every sense door perceives all these things, and we have piles of them. You know, but the fact that you perceive something, you see something, this is the moment that Buddha was trying to say. His perceiving her taking those two apples is not reality. It is a perception and nothing more. It is a mirage, like when we're driving on the highway and we think there's a whole, you know, river of water in front of us. It's a mirage. It's not true. But we treat our perceptions, our thoughts, the fact that we're conscious of what's going on, meaning that when we're asleep, we don't get caught up in the when we're awake, all of a sudden now, because we're conscious of what's going on, we're all caught up in it. The only time we get caught up in the khandhas when we're asleep is when we get caught up in some dream. And we're conscious of that dream, do we get caught up in the dream? This consciousness, this perception, this memory kind of emotional connection, feeling tones and form is not anything in and of itself. But when you take emotion, this is one way I look at emotions. When you take emotion and think of it as like twine, like rope, and you rope all that stuff together, wound it all up. It's all glued together now. Now, it is a reality. So his perception of seeing her take two apples became reality. His thoughts about it and getting caught up in it, he became caught up in his reality as if that was reality. And Dhamma, the practice, what we're trying to do, is find a way to break out of that. Break out of that getting caught in it. We're not trying to prevent it. That is almost impossible. Because as Lauren pointed out, we don't own this body. We can't make this body do what we want this body to do. We can't make our feelings. We can't say, I'm going to really love that broccoli. I'm going to love it. I'm going to taste it. I'm going to love it. I tried everything to get my son to eat peas. I mean, I think peas are great. I tried everything. I would slide a little pea in the middle of the applesauce, and he would eat around it and leave the little pea droppings in the bowl. He never would eat the peas. It's like he had this radar that said, peas, they don't look good. They don't taste good. I don't want it. I don't like it. That understanding is not in the peas. It's in his own perceptions of who he is. And it's not the reality of peas. So one way to think about emotions is they wrap us into some experience. So learning to practice with our emotions is a great way to begin to see how we are flooded in opinions about something, right? In some respects, it's great, though, he didn't say anything. It's great that the father did not say anything to her, like, oh, that's a little disappointing. Why would you do that? He didn't say anything. He just let the moment be. In a way, it's like mindfulness. We're not trying to fix what we see, because you can see if he tried to fix that moment, can you see how he's trying to fix something from an incorrect perception? But he doesn't know it's incorrect, and he could do more damage by trying to fix it. So instead, the notion of just not doing anything and let reality kind of come to us, or in our practice, it would be constantly trying to come back into the felt sense of the moment. Come back into the felt sense of the moment. And to take a breath before you impulsively say something based on what you think is going on. So you can think of emotions as the twine that wraps around our experience. And it's kind of, it's what sets in tone what we're experiencing. So his disappointment is what set in motion everything that he felt. Everything he thought, everything, it began to color the whole thing, and he was all lost in it. But there's another way you could also look at emotions as a practice piece. And you could look at emotions like the khandhas. You could look at emotions as being divided into three things. There are sensations going on. There are images going on, and there are thoughts going on. So you could begin, when you're caught in a really, really thick emotion, wound up in it, tightly wound, you can't, like, I'm so sad. The example I gave on Monday night was somebody said something really, really horrific about this poet that I just love. And I had this crash of, wait, what does that mean? I can't say these poems anymore? What? And I can't believe how sad I felt all day, because the person said it early in the morning. Sad all day, sad. But then Thursday night, when I was sharing it with the Thursday night group that I was sad, I realized, no, I'm not. I'm disappointed. That's the emotion I hate. I hate disappointment. And so instead, because I didn't actually work with the feeling, I just held it all day. I could have worked with this feeling, the quality of it. What are my thoughts? I noticed that the way I described it was, I was coming, the group began to talk about various moments when they've been caught in emotions. And some people get through those emotions by noticing their sensations. They notice the bodily feeling, and then they practice with it. And some people notice the sensation by, or notice the emotion by noticing whatever they're thinking. And then they're like, oh, I'm in that thinking process again. Let me step outside of this. Or let me, you know, like, see this more truly the way it is. And some people like me, I noticed that I kept replaying that moment in time. I kept replaying it over and over and over. And I realized, oh, I'm in this loop of this story. So I realized I was caught in it because of the seeing the image replay over and over and over. But that's one way to practice with the emotions, is to use them as the, because they're so strong, we can use them as the catalyst.
So two more things, and then we'll break out into breakout groups. First is, if we go back to that arrow sutta, the Buddha did not say non-practitioners feel the painful arrows and practitioners don't. What he said was both practitioners and non-practitioners, regular lay people, regular, you know, what he called run-of-the-mill, run-of-the-mill people, whatever that is, but worldling, that's my better one, ordinary worldling. So we both, us as practitioners, the people who don't practice in our world, we all feel that painful hit of the first arrow, first dart. What distinguishes us from people who don't practice is not the dart, the first dart. That is the nature of being human. It is looking for an escape from that dart other than pleasure. That's the distinction. So ordinary worldling, run-of-the-mill person, when they feel that painful dart, they don't like it, so they try to have some pleasure instead. Or they feel that painful dart because the dart itself is going to be painful. So they feel the painful dart, but it could be a pleasant feeling. And the pain of it is that they now have to keep that pleasant feeling going. They have to hold on to it. They have to claim it and they have to keep it or they're going to lose it. So this, they feel the dart. And as soon as they feel the dart, if they like it, they have to now hold it and keep it. If they don't like it, they have to get rid of it. We're stuck in that. A practitioner feels the same thing. The same way he felt that dart, just like he did, just like anybody else probably would think the same thing, very commonplace. We get hit with it. But somehow he allowed reality itself, when she pulled him out, to let it go. To not even, to just let it go. That's what we're practicing. How can I come back into reality, which is the four foundations of mindfulness, ways to establish mindfulness, feeling, tone, body, or we can use our thoughts and emotions, or we could use the dhammas itself. We can just say, oh, I'm going to practice with the aggregates, and then I'm going to start looking for them. But all of those things are bringing us into reality. And in reality, we can let go of the deluded thinking. And he realized it was deluded thinking as soon as she offered him the juicy one, the best one. He just let it go. He doesn't have to apologize to himself. He doesn't have to, oh my God, I can't believe I did that again. None of that. He's in reality now. He can just sit and eat the apple with her and they can have a nice time. You see, this is what, that's why these emotions in our everyday life become so important. But I want to save time for you guys to talk. For those of you that want to, if you don't want to, I can separate it. So thank you so much for your kind attention. And I'll set up some breakout rooms and give people who want an opportunity to bow out a chance to say goodbye, and I'll start setting up the rooms. All right, so I'll give you 15 minutes and I'll call you back. You can just, what comes up? That's it. That's not what's supposed to come up. What came up for you? And that's it. And leave it at that. And just listen to what other people, what came up for other people, so you can see that there's no perfect way for this to unfold. All right. I'll call you back in 15. So let's just see if anybody has any comments they want to share. Yeah, Charlotte?
That was so very helpful. Both the meditation by Susan and also your talk, Terry. I had an upset this morning from a text and we talked through it, and just being with the emotions is, and for me, the emotion, the response is embarrassment. I was embarrassed a lot as a child. And when I feel embarrassed, I start flipping out and getting angry. So thank you. That was very helpful to discover that.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah, I know it's again. It's same with me. I mean, hell, I've been practicing 30 years and I was stuck in sadness. And it was really disappointment, my nemesis. I decided I'm going to heaven. And when I get to heaven, but tell St. Peter, enough of this disappointment. That is the emotion we need to get up out of there. It's not necessary that we feel disappointment. There's thousands of emotions. We don't have to have one that says disappointment. That's what you can bank on. So I'm going, when I go up, I'm telling. That's what I'm going to do. Is it Bruce?
Yeah.
Hi. Yeah, I saw you.
There's something I brought up in the group, something I've been thinking about. Apparently emotions aren't real, correct?
They're not. We experience them as real.
I experience them as more real than anything else.
That's right.
I mean,
they do.
I've been searching for what's real for 40 years plus. And the most real thing I can imagine is something that's not supposed to be real.
Right. And it's only not real because it is a conglomerate. It is piles of stuff bound together. And the piles of stuff bound together make it seem real. But when you try to actually find the realness to it, it's hard. That's the way you can tell whether emotions are real. See if you can find where sadness actually is, because it's difficult. There's feelings, and the feelings, if you think about the feelings themselves, that's not sad. But then there's thoughts. If you didn't have the thoughts and you only had the feelings, would it be sad? I don't know. Mm-hmm. If you have only the thoughts and you don't have any feeling, is that sad? I don't know what it is. So when you put it all together, it feels real. But when in reality, it's usually separate.
Oh, thanks.
Is it Jean or John?
Me.
Okay.
So in our group, we all owned up to the fact that we make up stories about other people. And John and I do it. We don't set out to do it, but we're aware of it. And we sort of joke with each other. But, you know, and that little video, which was so good, the dad got almost immediate feedback that he had misperceived his daughter's, you know, state of mind. And in life, that doesn't always happen, unless it might be like a slam, you know, like, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, or some, you know, it's kind of like that. But mostly we get to churn on this stuff and further slam ourselves with the second arrows because we're not
getting
the feedback, or we ignore the feedback, right?
But as practitioners, we have the ability to always get immediate feedback.
Yeah, that's what I want to say, that by bringing awareness to it, hopefully we see it more. Like, maybe that's not true. I don't know what's true, but maybe that's not my first thought about this situation is not necessarily true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can always ask the mantra, is that true? Mm. Is this true?
It's true.
Am I in reality or am I in thinking? Where am I here? Which one am I? Just a random thought in general. Am I in thinking? Am I in reality? You know, my own world or reality? And this constant coming back. That's what our practice is designed to help us do that. So that when we get stuck in something like that and we don't have immediate feedback, we won't just stay in that loop. We have a
had the training of always using the four foundations as a establishment of mindfulness. Good, G. Carol?
As usual, when a new subject comes up, I find it's much deeper and whatever, more complex than I ever thought it was. And so I would say that I'm like one step backwards, but I think it clarified our discussion that first and foremost, it's not that I have to decide whether my emotion is correct or not, or my reaction is correct or not. There has to just be awareness of what it is. And so, like, what am I feeling? And like what Charlotte was saying, does it lead back to something? And am I bouncing back to something else? Because if there's, you know, emotions, like you said, they're not real, then I'm saying I shouldn't be feeling this. But I think that the whole idea is, what is the point of meditation here? Is become aware of where I am in that moment, whatever it is, and not to judge it, but to say, what is it that's going on here? And in the moment, in fact. And so we can't really say that the guy was wrong in those perceptions, but maybe he just needed to know what he was thinking better or something like that. It just went too far, that clip, actually, in terms of what it is like. I made a mistake, and shouldn't I have made this mistake? But I think just awareness is the first component that's
important. That's right. But I guess I want to. Somebody one time told me I shouldn't use the word real, and I didn't understand at the time. But I'm understanding and listening to you, Carol, why we might want to change this word from real.
Yeah.
And a way to think about it is like this. We saw what he saw, and she did take both. So it's not like his emotion of maybe disappointment is not real. It is not reality. It is not the entirety of what is reality. It is just a sliver, a pile, an aspect, but we treat it as if it is the reality and the only reality. Whatever we perceived that allowed us to feel disappointment, sadness, anger, whatever it is, we think that is reality. And really, it's just a pile in a series of experiences as part of reality. That's what I think the Buddha was pointing to. Not so much that I shouldn't say emotions aren't real, but they are not reality. They are just an aspect of that reality. And they are coming from our perceptions and not from necessarily what actually happens. I mean, it's our perception of what happens that causes our emotions. Do you see? Can you see it that way? Bruce, is that better? Is it easier to see it that way? So yes, you are experiencing something, but it is not necessarily the sum total of reality. And I think that's what Jean was trying to get at, that there's a whole range of things going on. And all of it are little piles of stuff that are going on. And we tend to zero in on one and think that that is reality. We better stop. And we have one more week of talking about emotions. This is great, though. It really brings this whole series. I didn't realize it would bring the Dhamma so close to home, but I'm grateful for it.